This message comes from NPR sponsor Viore, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to viore.com/NPR.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. It's rap month on our show. And all month we are bringing you nothing but rappers. First up this week is Angie Stone. Now, you might be thinking, wait, this Angie Stone? And yeah, that Angie Stone, who, as you can hear, is singing on that track from her 2001 album Mahogany Soul. She's a hit maker as a singer, but also this Angie Stone. I rock the Army, Air Force, and the Navy, 2-1 nation, underfunk, red, white, and blue. C-A is for Angie, B is for bad, something that your MCs never had. Cause when I walk in your party, my first thought to battle, I know for a fact it's an MC battle. Give it up, dish it out, do what you wanna do, cause we're the sequence, and we're busting new. That's a song called Funky Sound, Tear the Roof Off, from 1981. The artist, The Sequence, one of the first ever all-women rap groups. Cheryl the Pearl, Blondie, and Angie B, now known as Angie Stone, high school friends turned hip-hop pioneers. So suffice it to say that Angie Stone has some stories to tell. You'll hear those in a minute. But before we get to them, let's hear a little bit of Angie's new album, Love Language, which came out earlier this year. This track is called The Gym. And, you know, it's about love and the gym.
It's like I'm sweating you just for second place. I'm on a chase for love, but without an embrace. Heavy on my heart, my soul, mind, and body. Take it easy, I'm out of shape. And the weight is starting to wear me down. Like a dumbbell, I stuck around. Adding pound after pound, I was in love with him.
Hey, but this ain't working out.
It's nothing like the gym.
Angie Stone, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
How did you decide that you're going to have a record that is about love in the gym?
Well, you know, when you're going through the ups and downs of life, the roller coaster of, you know, deciding whether you want to stay involved or, you know, go through, it's like being in a gym. So you really have to exercise mentally, emotionally to get through something. And that was what inspired this whole gym move. Something that says, hey, it is what it is, but at the end of the day, you know, everybody has to go through something. So you have to find a way to, you know, exert all that energy. And that's what that was for.
I feel like at the point in your career that you're at, you've been making love and relationship songs for 30 years. At a certain point, you just must have a giant Filofax or something of possible love metaphors. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. But my metaphors have more to do with the world in general, not just mine. So I can look at your situation or a family member situation and internalize it. So all of my music does not speak of just my emotion. It's emotion in general.
Did you think you were going to be a singer when you were a kid?
To be honest with you, I did think I would be a singer. As a matter of fact, when it was asked, what do you plan on doing in your life? I said I wanted to be a star.
Like in elementary school?
Mm-hmm. In elementary school, I knew then that I wanted to be a singer. I stayed in the mirror doing this, you know? So it was, in my mind, it was a no-brainer. This is what I was born to do.
Your father was an amateur singer, semi-professional singer? Is that so?
My father was a gospel singer. He was a quartet singer.
What did you think of that?
I loved it because that's what trained me as an artist to be diversified, to harmonize, to really focus on that, you know, thing that has made me famous, harmonizing and arrangement.
Did he and his group ever rehearse at the house?
All the time. That was what I learned from. That was the template that I learned from.
What did they sing?
Gospel, you know, Canton spirituals, all kind of, you know, gospel songs that kind of reached home. So it was easier said than done for me to sit and watch them rehearse. And it was a group of them. So they would sing and harmonize and laugh and joke. And, you know, I would just take it all in.
Did you think it was cool that your dad was a singer? Or did you think it was, did you wish your dad was in the, you know, in the stylistics or in Parliament instead of singing gospel?
Oh, no. I thought it was real cool that my dad was a singer, and I thought, you know, he was different. I thought I would learn from him because I thought he was dope.
Did you sing with him?
Mm-hmm. All the time. You know, my dad used to, I was the only child, so my dad used to impart that in me very quickly. You know, he would always say, you can do this.
When did you start singing with friends at home?
When I was 11.
What happened?
Just stopped doing talent shows and putting stuff together, wanting to do competition for the parks and stuff like that.
Did you, like, survey your friend group and know who could sing and start recruiting, or how did it work out?
Well, we kind of knew who was built to do this because they were dedicated, they were loyal to themselves. So, you know, you kind of knew. You ain't had time for nobody who wasn't serious about it.
Who was serious about it?
Everybody that I was working with had to be serious about it. Or else you couldn't play with us.
I mean, but at the same time, you're talking about 11, 12 years old. I don't think I was serious about anything when I was 11 or 12 years old.
Yeah, you're serious about the talent. If you want to really, you know, give off that energy, you push yourself with your friends because you're trying to accomplish something. So for me, that win, that talent show, and that hustle and flow was what made us tick.
What's the first contest or show that you remember singing in?
I sang in a local, park center, called Saxon Home, the recreation room. And we did a song. I did a song called Love on a Two-Way Street. Ironically, ended up being signed to the lady many years later, not knowing she would be, you know, play a part in my life.
I found love on a two-way street and lost it on a lonely highway. Love on a two-way street, lost on a lonely highway.
What did your dad think about it?
Oh, my dad loved it. He loved the fact that, you know, I was a singer. And he love the fact that I was learning from him.
What kind of things did you learn from him?
I learned how to arrange, just listening close to the movement. I mimicked it. And it was, you know, easy for me because he was my dad.
More still to come with Angie Stone. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Angie Stone. She's a soul singer and once upon a time was a rapper as well. She co-founded the all-woman hip-hop group The Sequence in 1979. When did you first hear rap?
Oh, my God. We heard a song that King Tim III did before the Sugar Hill Gang had come out with the record. We heard this song and knew then, you know, something was happening in the world. Just wasn't sure what, but we were inspired by King Tim III.
Here we go. You stomp your feet because you're listening to the sound of the shimp shot beat. I'm the K-I-N-G, the T-I-M, King Tim the Third, and I am here. Just me, Fat Fat, and the crew. We're doing it all just for you. We're strong as an ox and tall as a tree. We can rock you so viciously. We throw the hives in your eyes, the bass in your face. We're the funk machines that rock the human race. Skate down, boogie shot. Come on, girl, let's do the rock. Slam dunk, do the jerk.
His record, Personality Jock, it was kind of like a patter record. Like it was like in the style of an FM radio DJ who rhymed on song intros, which was like a thing that had been going on for 10, 12 years at that point, something like that.
Right. And you had, you know, so many DJs that were taking that position. But, you know, Casey III had done his little thing, and he was flowing with it, and we were just, you know, smitten by it.
How old are you?
Ooh, I think we were 12, 14, somewhere in there, 14, 15.
You're saying R&B songs at the rec center and gospel songs with your dad and maybe Sundays at church. Did you start writing rhymes with your friends at the playground?
Not right away, but we started writing rhymes after we heard King Tim III. We started writing rhymes. So at that point, we were, you know, it was easier to flow because we had a lead to follow. But other than that, we didn't, you know, there was no template other than that for us to build our, you know, vibe on. We started to create and be our own entity at that point.
Wham, bam, the monster jammer. Get up, everybody, and do the freak to the beat. Wham, bam, the monster jammer. Get up, everybody, and do the freak to the beat. You're the S to the P, double O-N-Y. You're the one MC I'll never deny. You better watch out, and I tell you why. Cause I'm Angie B, I might give you a try. Now you're looking in my eyes and you're in a trance. And all you can think of is my sweet romance. Hey, Spoonie G, I'm Angie B, and I'd like to know what you got for me.
Well, I'm a
when you started The Sequence, which was the group that sort of made your music career when you were in your teens,
mm-hmm.
did the three of you think of yourselves as a singing group or a rap group?
Absolutely a rap group. Now, I was a singer because I had a band and wanted to kind of put things together. But, you know, we were clearly still young, so we were trying to do it all.
I think for a lot of people, hearing Rapper's Delight on the radio, especially outside certain parts of New York City where there was like parties where rappers were, you know, rapping on stage and MCs were MCing.
Right.
A lot of people describe that moment when they heard Rapper's Delight on the radio as like as a light bulb. Were you already rapping by the time that record hit?
Yeah, we were doing, you know, like I said, we had never heard them. So we were doing our inversion of Funk You Up based off of, you know, following King Tim the Third's vibe. So by the time we heard Sugar Hill Gang, we were like, what in the world is this? Because it was super long, but it was familiar because they had used a familiar record. So it kind of blew us away, but it was so much fun and incredible, you know.
I said a hip. The hibbit of a hip, hip hopper, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, bubba to the boogity bang bang, the boogie to the boogity beat. Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang bang, the boogie to the boogie, say up jump the boogie to the bang bang boogie, let's rock.
The 12-inch mix of Rapper's Delight is like 12 minutes long or something like that.
Exactly.
And they just rap and rap and rap and rap and rap and rap and rap until they're out of things to say, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. And that was the nature of hip-hop back then. They just, you know, rapped and they were doing books, in my opinion, paragraphs and tablets of rhyme, because, you know, you had to take up every concept of music or beat. You had to fill it with something. So that was the nature of hip hop back then to me.
Do you remember any of the raps that you wrote when you were that age?
Oof. Not really, to be real honest with you. Outside of Funk You Up, I don't remember them all. You know, some of the ones that we recorded, absolutely. But you got to remember, you're talking 50 years ago.
Were you guys performing at parties and stuff?
We were performing at our school performances and, you know, hip hops. We called them hops back then. You know, there was a DJ and he was spinning records and give us the mic and walk. We were just be having, you know, the school would have a party and we would have a party within a party.
The Sequence weren't just the first female rap group with a hit record, but also the first Southern rap group with a hit record. You know, you weren't in the Bronx at block parties, you know, whatever that story of hip hop is. You were in the Carolinas. Did you feel like this was a thing that was visiting from far away that you were jumping into, or did it feel like did it feel like home?
It felt like home. I will say that it was hard because, you know, you had to create the template. It was a, you know, you didn't have a huge lead to follow. So, you know, along the way, you were the crash test dummy. So, and when I say that, I say it loosely because you had to create the story, make it make sense, try to sell yourself, the joy of it, and have fun in the meantime. So all of it was, you know, it was a part of the history of hip-hop overall, southern, northern, however you want to slice it. Everybody had their appeal, and we had ours.
How did you get signed when you were 600 miles away from the entire hip-hop world?
Well, I think having an original, clever idea and a southern accent is what spawned the idea of Sylvia signing the group. I think we got signed because we were original. We were not like anything out there. But, you know, because we were different, because we were from the South, we stood a better chance than most because we were different.
And this is Sylvia Robinson of Sugar Hill Records.
Correct.
How did you get your music to her? Did you send her a tape?
No, we actually snuck. Well, I won't say snuck in, but we got invited to a concert, which the Sugar Hill Gang was in the Township Auditorium in Columbia, South Carolina. We just happened to be there. Harold Miles, who was their road manager at the time, let us be backstage, brought us to the stage. You know, he was liking me, and so he was just trying to please the girls, and we were trying to get in a concert. We ended up getting in and getting all the way through, meeting Sylvia, only to find out that was their first tour. The first leg of their tour was the first stop they made, and on that stop, we were there. We got picked up.
So you're talking about the three of you were just hanging out outside trying to figure out how to get in?
Correct. We were hanging out. This guy that used to work with Blondie got us tickets. He wanted to try to manage us or do some stuff, and he said, I'll get you tickets to get in. And so he had promised us that he would leave passes. We went there thinking there were passes, only to find out there weren't any passes. So we had to, you know, work our way in. So we weren't hanging out. The beauty of it was Harold Miles, who was the Sugar Hill Gang's road manager, is the guy that actually brought us in backstage after he discovered us, because he wanted to, you know, talk to me and flirt. And I was just a baby, but I wanted to get in. So I followed the lead. And that's how we end up getting in backstage. And voila, the group got signed. We met Sylvia Robinson, and the rest is history.
Do you remember what it was like when you got backstage? I mean, that's like a heady place to be, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I was excited. You know, I was just like most other teenagers who get to meet, you know, idols. All of a sudden, we're backstage with one of the hottest groups in the country. Of course, you're ecstatic. You're extremely excited. So for us, it was it was delightful. Let's put it that way.
Did you know who Sylvia Robinson was, or recognize her, or like, how did you get from I'm backstage to, hey, important record label boss, we're a music group, listen to us rap?
Well, I'll tell you this way. Sylvia was more my mom's cup of tea. You know, she had a song, Pillow Talk. I really didn't know of her like that. But, you know, once I realized I was amongst stars, she was a beautiful, beautiful person. When I saw and I recognized we were amongst that level of starship, you know, I kind of tripped out because I'm like, how in the world did we get here? And then I realized that it was ordained for us to be in that spot at that particular time. And Sylvia knew just what to do. And, you know, when you sit back and think about it, as surprising as it is, is not as surprising as you really think it is, because at the end of the day, you're there and you're supposed to be there. So I began to realize that a lot of things started to happen as a result of it's supposed to happen. And I think hip hop back then for us, being the first female group or with an original rap record and a Southern group, all of that was a part of history that we generally didn't have anything to do with, but ended up having everything, you know, to be responsible for. So I'm grateful we got the position and the timing to get it done.
Did she like stand up in the back of the room and say, "Hello, I'm music industry impresaria Sylvia Robinson. Just would anyone here like to rap for me?"
No, Sylvia Robinson was very cool, calm, and collective. She knew what she wanted. She knew what she was doing. Every move was calculated. She did what she was supposed to do to be the boss that she ended up being.
So how did you end up auditioning for her?
We didn't audition. I actually got backstage. Once we got backstage, we saw the Chicken Gang rapper. We said, we could do that. And she said, "Well, let me hear what you got." And I think when she heard the hook, "Funk You Up," she was so smitten by our accents that the accent alone is what sold the record. And as we began to open up that song, her eyes opened up, and it was just like she began to hear in the spirit that, oh, my God, this is going to be huge.
Right on up, we're going to funk. Over there, you better get up out of your chair and work your body down. No time to funk around, cause we gon' funk you right on up. We're gonna funk you right on up.
I'm gonna funk you up.
What did your parents say when you came home from the concert and said, "Mom, Dad, I went to the concert over at the Civic Center or the arena or whatever it was, and anyway, long story short, I have a record contract, and next week I'm going to New York"?
My mother didn't believe it, and my dad was like, "Girl, sit down somewhere." You know, in his mind, I was talking out my face crazy because that could never happen. And unfortunately, you know, my dad and them didn't believe it for a long time.
For a long time after that?
Yeah, they didn't believe it until, you know, Miss Robinson reached out and said, "I want to sign these girls."
So much more with Angie Stone still to come. Her first hits with her group, The Sequence, were when she was a teenager, but she had her first hit solo records as a singer much later in her career. She was about 20 years older than everybody else on the charts. We'll talk about what that was like. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
If you need a laugh and you're on the go, try STOPPODCASTI.
Oh, you trying to put the name of the podcast there?
Yeah, I'm trying to spell it, but it's tricky.
Let me give it a try.
Okay.
If you need a laugh and you're on the go, call STOPPAD. It'll never fit.
No, it will. Let me try. If you need a laugh and you're on the go, try STOPPDCOO. We are so close.
Stop podcasting yourself.
A podcast from MaximumFun.org.
If you need a laugh, and you're on the go.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, my guest is Angie Stone. She is a hit-making soul singer, a Grammy nominee, and a co-founding member of The Sequence. They were the first hit-making all-woman rap group. They signed to Sugar Hill Records in 1979. Let's get back into our conversation. As your record started to get out onto the radio, was there a moment when you felt like this is real?
Well, there are moments that you feel like it's real, but then there it's more unreal, believe it or not, because you have to, you know, put in your mind that, oh, wow, is this, you know, like really happening for me?
Did you think this was going to be your life when, you know, when you were on big package tours and going on TV and you had a hit record on the radio and stuff?
Well, I definitely didn't think this would be a part of my world. I just never saw it, could never dream, imagine it, because I never knew what, you know, being a celebrity or being a star felt like or what to expect. I never dreamed that big or that far.
But it didn't go on forever. You came home eventually. You ended up actually having a kid and getting married.
Mm-hmm.
So once you got into domestic life, were you trying to figure out what your music career was if you were married with a child?
Absolutely. Not sure how I was going to do this, being, you know, straight out of high school, no diploma, no degrees, no focus other than this music thing. Now I got a whole family and life to lead and limited resources, you know, to get there. So you don't really put it together and know how you're going to, you know, make it pan out. And that was my issue.
And I mean, hip hop was moving so fast in those years. Like,
yes,
you know, you were old fashioned style wise 2 years after you came out. You know what I mean?
Yes, old fashioned, and, you know, still in that way, because we, you know, we have what they call mother wit, which is, you know, when we kind of set in our ways. So you're absolutely right.
So at what point did you realize, oh, I have the singing chops to be a singer for my career and move towards that?
Well, I've always known singing was my passion. It was the one thing that got me to rapping, and that was singing. So I knew, being a church girl and being someone who had, you know, my father being a quartet singer, I knew my calling was more there than anywhere. It had been prophesied to me that my career, my greatest time would come later in my, as I got older. It would, my career would not reach the stratosphere in my early teens. It would be in my 30s or late, you know, close to 40, that I would find the success that I ended up finding. And even though it was told to me, it was very accurate. Yeah, I ended up becoming successful or getting my best, you know, foot forward at a later age in the game.
Who prophesied it to you?
a prophet.
A secret prophet?
No, a prophet. You know, I'm a very spiritual person. So, you know, prophetically, if it's told to me or spoken over me, I, you know, either choose to believe it or disbelieve it. And certain things I do believe. And that was one that I did believe in. And right, and it was right and exact. So, yeah.
What was it like for you when you were making hit records in the late 90s, early 2000s, and you were 40-ish, and you were making hit records alongside singers who were 24. Like, how did that change your relationship to your peers?
It really didn't change my relationship to my peers. It made me more comfortable to fit in, you know, and be accepted for who I am, as opposed to being judged for who I'm not. So It wasn't bad for me. It was actually a good thing.
Angie Stone, I sure am grateful for your time. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Man, thank you. I had a wonderful time. Thank you for your patience. I know I twisted my ankle yesterday. I know they told you about that, but listen, we're okay. As much as I'd like to say thank you to the rest of the world, I want to thank you guys for taking the time out to, you know, just be interested in my little life.
Angie Stone, her latest album, Love Language, is out now. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. I thought I got rid of these stupid moths that were eating my clothes, but it turned out I didn't. I'm really mad about it. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow here at Maximum Fun is Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by the great DJ W, also known as Dan Wally. Our thanks to Robert Gall for recording Angie Stone in her home. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation, written and recorded by the Go team. Thanks to them, and thanks to Memphis Industries, their label. Go follow us on Instagram at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. See pictures of folks who roll through the studio and how we do what we do and who's coming up on the show and all that kind of stuff. At Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on Instagram. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.